Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 8th of April 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is actually the 33rd episode in the series. Maybe it's gone on a little longer than we thought, but I think it is still interesting, particularly interesting now as we are getting into British history. And of course, I have with me today my co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts community. Patriarch, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm well, thanks. I had a little bit of a bug the other day. It wasn't COVID, but travel bug, and the changing weather, I think sometimes kind of hits you, doesn't it? But it was only like a 2-day thing, but I'm all right now.
Oh, you're sounding good tonight. You're sounding clear and sounding awake and alert and keen to get on with the show. But just before we start, just let me ask, how is the Patriotic Arts community doing? How are things doing there?
Well, we're on a little break at the moment. So we will be kind of getting things back on track probably in the next month. And I think we'll probably be doing, instead of a monthly contest, we'll be doing sort of like a seasonal contest instead, just so it gives people a lot more time to meet deadlines and so on, and you know, things can be promoted a little bit more. So we'll probably kick things off again kind of towards the end of spring, ready for a summer reboot.
Sounds like a good idea, tying it in with the seasons and traditions. Mm-hmm. And of course, any artists or musicians, writers, get yourself on Telegram and look up the Patriotic Arts community and join in the chat room there and help out with creating, where you'll find other people that will appreciate your work and that you can bounce your ideas off. Well, let's get into episode 33 then. We will be quoting again from the British Cymry, or the Britons of Cambria, Outlines of Their History and Institutions from the Earliest to the Present Times by Reverend Richard Williams Morgan, and that book was published in 1857. And we will also be using a few notes that have been taken from Wikipedia. Now, in the reign of Rune, the son of Lyell, the founder of Carlisle and Chester, in BC 892, which is the era when Zechariah was prophesying in Judea, the first of the three Confederate expeditions commemorated in the Welsh Triads went forth from Britain. Urb, the grandson of Assaracus, the son of Evroc the Great, you remember he was the guy that founded York, being driven from his territories in Scandinavia, or Loch Lynn as it was known, landed at Kartroia, which was the ancient name for London, with but one attendant, Mathata Vawa. Presenting himself before Rune and the National Council, he implored them to pledge their solemn oath that they would grant him his petition. Moved by this appeal of the royal exile, they inadvertently consented to his request. Urb asked that from every capital fortress in the kingdom he might take as many armed men as he entered it with. Rune, bound by the oath of the council, was obliged to give the required permission, but immediately foreseeing the consequences, issued on edict that no Briton should on pain of death enter any fortress with Urb. Neither threats nor persuasion, however, could shake the fidelity of the prince's gigantic squire, and in defiance of all preventive measures, Urb entered the first fortress with Mathata Vawa by his side. From this he took two, from the second four, from the third eight, and so on, till the fighting force of the island was found insufficient to supply the demand, exceeding 120,000 men, made on the 17th city. We actually find that our early histories are full of things like this, where you would ask somebody to give a pledge to you, and then you would slightly trick them with what you actually asked them to do. It reminds me of when the Saxons came, and they said, "Can we have a bit of land?" And Vortigern said, "Yes, I'll give you a bit of land." And they said, "We only want a bit of land that this oxhide can go around." And he said, "Okay, we'll give you a bit of land that will fit within the oxhide." And then they cut the oxhide up in such a manner that it took over the whole of Kent and they were given Kent. Mm. And I think there was a similar story with Carthage, wasn't there? An ox hide. Oh, yeah, when we were talking about Carthage.
I think I vaguely remember that, yeah.
Something similar. So,
interesting.
So what's happened here is he's had his territories taken away from him in Scandinavia, so he's come back to Britain to raise an army to go back and get his territory back. And again, that's something we regularly hear happening in British history, because the British kings often had lands elsewhere, like in Brittany or in Normandy, and they would lose their territory, come back to Britain, raise an army, and then try and win their territory back. So this is just basically showing that this happened many years ago. And the same happens with the Danes as well. They had territory that they took in Britain, and they lost it, and they would go back to Daneland and then come back with an army and take it back again. Anything else you'd like to add to that?
I just think it's quite interesting that I didn't really think that people of Britain used to kind of venture outwards to capture land elsewhere. Because I'd always heard of like the Normans, Saxons and the Vikings kind of raiding into the British Isles, but I'd never heard of it the other way around before. So it's quite interesting.
Well, they were the traditional raiders. As we heard in an earlier episode, they were quite piratical. The Rus as well, the Rus, the Vikings and the Saxons, their lands that they had weren't very good for farming. So what they would do is when they had too many men, they would go out and look for somewhere to colonize. But yeah, the British didn't do that because we had all the tin here. We had good farmland. And what's happened here is he's lost his kingdom. He's been driven out of his kingdom. Now, I'm not sure whether we covered him earlier, but I mean, he may have had that kingdom through marriage to a princess there, or he may have been given that kingdom for services given fighting for another monarch. So there are different reasons why he may have been given that. This isn't like a pirating trip to go and steal land. It's to go and get land back.
Yeah, it's obviously a vendetta. Maybe he made connections with people that came over here and had settled, and joint marriage and ties were made that way.
Yeah, dynastic marriages, they took place all the time, not just in Europe. Erb accordingly set sail with the 60,000 already levied for Scandinavia. By their assistance, he soon recovered his throne. Part of this armament settled in the country called after them the Cumbric or Cymric Chersonese, which is now Denmark. So that's interesting. Denmark used to be called the Cymric Chersonese. From these descended first the terrible Cymbri, who in alliance with the Teutons overthrew and destroyed so many armies of Rome, and secondly, in after ages, the Norman race, who conquered Normandy, Saxon England, and other lands. The facility with which the Normans fused and intermarried with the Cymry and the Bretons, identifying themselves with their history and traditions, explains itself by this community of descent. The other moiety of the host of Erb followed up their career of conquest across Europe to the lands of Galas and Avenia, Galatia and Ionia in Asia Minor, and these are the Cymry to whom the Greek and Latin authors assign the subjugation of the East prior to the foundation of the Persian Empire by Cyrus, or Chris. That was probably actually pronounced Chris back then, because we didn't have a C word, we just had a K word. So that's interesting. So that explains the origin of the Celts that were in the East, and they actually came from Denmark, and they were actually made up of Britons as well as the Danes. So this is this, go on.
I was going to say that the Danes, aren't they kind of linked to Phoenicians?
The Danes, I've got a book, the Book of the Danes, and that was written in the 10th century, and that talks about them sort of making their way into Europe. They're travelers. They're colonizers, pioneers, and they're also pirates, and they make their way in. But it doesn't really sort of say where from. Their gods, the Odin and Woden, go back to kings, and I think they talk about being in Asia Minor, in Turkey. So yeah, they do talk about coming from that area, and they have lots of battles with the with the Rus. And if you talk to the Danes, they'll talk about the Cimmerians and being descended from the Cimmerians or having something to do with the Cimmerians. And that's obviously...
Cymru.
It's the Cymru. It's the same reference that we have here.
Linked to Scythians, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the Cimmerians and the Scythians were originally the same people. It was a word that could be used for... It came from Cymru, which was the word for... which was the Assyrian word for them. And then Scythian was the other word, and I can't recall exactly what language it was in. Maybe Babylonian, Akkadian.
Mm-hmm.
Akkadian, because they were called Habiru, Scythian, and Cymri, and all three of those words are used to describe the same people on the Behistun rock carving, which was carved by. Either Cyrus or the Darius II, I think, the king before Cyrus, was actually
and carved by him. That rock was it was designed specifically to cross reference different languages, wasn't it? So you could understand, kind of from multiple perspectives of who it was. Basically, the context of the writing,
similar to the Rosetta Stone. Which is how we were able to decipher the Egyptian hieroglyphs. It had Egyptian hieroglyphs, and then it had it in Assyrian, and then in Babylonian as well, and Latin maybe. So we were actually able to understand them. And it was the same thing with the Behistun rock. So there we have where the British link is to these other Cymru that are on the continent, and obviously there's the Cymru that were linked with Crimea as well. That has its origins in the Cymru, that word. No individual of the Confederate host of Urb ever returned, state the triads, to Britain. They settled in the conquered countries. The three Confederate are also termed the three silver hosts of Britain. They were all picked men, and their arms were of the three metals, gold, silver, and steel. This account is in harmony with the astonishment expressed by the classic writers at the splendid character of the equipment of both the infantry and the cavalry in the Cymric armies. The three Confederate are known too as the three inconsiderate hosts because they laid the island open to the three capital invasions, those of the Coronidae, the Romans, and the Saxons. The drain caused by this expedition on the military resources of the island enabled the Coronidae, a marine tribe from the lowlands of the continent facing the eastern side of Britain, to establish themselves between the Humber and the Wash. This was the earliest Teutonic or German settlement. They are the Coritani of the Roman writers. They acknowledged allegiance and paid tribute to the British crown at Car Troia, but were invariably false in critical emergencies, such as a foreign invasion, to the national cause. And I think when we get to the Roman times, we'll see that the Coronidae or the Coritani end up being traitors, basically, and shifting their allegiance to Rome. So that's interesting. That explains how the Saxons were able to take over. And because all the fighting men of the island had actually left the island at that time.
And so wage war elsewhere.
Yeah. And it ties in with King Arthur, actually, when King Arthur went onto the continent and he took all his men with him. We'll get to that later on. Hrun was succeeded by Bledin or Bladud, who built Car Badon or Bath and constructed therein a magnificent circular temple. And Bladud is seen as a legendary king. There isn't much that is known about him. I've heard Jacob Rees-Mogg mention Bladud in the Houses of Parliament, and there are references to him around Bath. There's a statue of him, and he's the legendary founder of Bath. And I've got some notes on him from Wikipedia. Bladud allegedly founded the city of Bath because while he was in Athens, he contracted leprosy. When he returned home, he was imprisoned as a result, but escaped and went far off to go into hiding. he found employment as a swineherd at Swainswick, about 2 miles from the later site of Bath, and he noticed that his pigs would go into an alder moor in cold weather and return covered in black mud. He found that this mud was warm and that the pigs wallowed to enjoy the heat. He also noticed that the pigs which did this did not suffer from skin diseases as the others did, and on trying the mud bath himself, he found that he was cured of his leprosy. He was then restored to his position as heir apparent to his father, and he founded Bath so that others might also benefit as he had done. So this is interesting because it shows that we had contact with Athens, and we had our kings would go to Athens, and we had that report of the druid that spoke as if he'd been educated at the Lyceum, and that was a report given by somebody in Athens. And I would say this is probably a little bit later, 7th century. Although we, and I'm saying that because this is obviously a time when Athens was civilized, but as we heard last week, it was the Britons that actually had their alphabet before the Greeks did. It was the Britons that taught the Greeks their alphabet, and if that is the case, then this could have been all the way back then.
Yeah, I'm just doing a research now on his name, and he seems to be depicted as kind of with wings. I don't know what the reference is there.
We're just going to get to that. Bladud also encouraged the practice of necromancy or divination through the spirits of the dead. Through this practice, he is said to have constructed wings for himself and to have tried to fly to or from the Temple of Apollo in Trinovantium, London, or Troy Nova, New Troy, but to have been killed when he hit a wall, or to have fallen and been dashed to pieces, or to have broken his neck. He was supposedly buried at New Troy and succeeded by his son, Lear. So this is really the earliest reference that we have to someone trying to fly. And he basically, I don't know whether it was a hang glider, and he took off from the tallest building that they had, or what. But that's the other legend that he is famous for, is for trying to fly.
I think it's interesting. It makes me wonder to what extent is the kind of exaggeration and kind of mythical kind of folklore, you know, with them being perceived as having wings, and it's almost like Icarus, isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
clearly Icarus wasn't real. So I just wonder if over the years the tales of them had been exaggerated.
I think Icarus made wings, didn't he, and with wax, and then the wax melted when he got too close to the sun. And you can see from that there probably was an attempt at flying, and the attempt failed. And I think it's probably the same here. I think there was an attempt at flying. Could well have been a hang glider. I mean, you only have to watch butterflies, or watch leaves float, watch leaves go up in the air with hot air to understand that a hot air balloon might float. Maybe they develop something like a paper aeroplane or a hang glider. I mean, the principles of actually flying you would get from watching the birds soaring, wouldn't you? So I think it is feasible that they could try and make some way of flying, make some wings, and try it out.
Possible. Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I just wonder if it has just more symbolic reference as a whole into kind of pertaining to his life, the things he went through, and you know, maybe it could be symbolic of him kind of overcoming certain things.
Well, it could be, and also, I mean, for everybody to have remembered this, and to have remembered that we had this king that tried to fly and died as a result of it, there's got to be some truth there somewhere in the legend. And it doesn't say that he was gluing feathers together like Icarus made an attempt at actually making wings with feathers, didn't he, which obviously isn't really going to work. But it just says that he tried to fly some kind of flying contraption, so we don't really know exactly what it was. And there were embellished accounts that were written in the 15th and the 16th century about this, and the Wikipedia will tell you that the first mention of this was in the history of the kings of England, Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of England. But the Welsh triads, which go back to the much earlier texts that were all written in the original British alphabet, they referred to this. That's where Geoffrey of Monmouth got his history from, from the Welsh texts. So there may have been more details there.
Yeah, well, it says through this practice, so it was inspired. If he did choose to kind of pursue flying, it was inspired by necromancy and divination and, you know, I guess occultic practices, right?
Well, yeah, it could have been, or it could have just been that they didn't understand what he was using, the technology that he was using, and that would have appeared to be magic to them. I mean, there was no difference between magic and science at that time.
Yeah.
You know, the two were sort of blended in together. So, and they may have thought that he'd been given the information on how to build this flying machine through the spirits. And he may have believed that. But we don't have enough details about it. But he is well known, and there's a statue of him in Bath, and there's one of those boards that says that Bladud was the original founder of Bath. And also the bit about how he saw that the pigs would return covered in black mud, and their skin was much better than the others, because that's what those baths are supposed to do. They're supposed to be very good for the complexion, and the Romans used it as well. So what this is saying is Bath was used for the hot springs before the Romans got there. It had already been developed. It had already been set up by Bladud and named after him, Badon.
Right.
Before the Romans. Well, he was succeeded by his son Lear, the founder of Carlea or Leicester, the closing scenes of whose long and peaceful reign, in connection with the unnatural ingratitude of his two elder daughters and the affecting devotion of his youngest daughter Cordelia, has been made familiar to the European world by the dramatic pen of Shakespeare. So that's where we have heard of King Lear from, is because Shakespeare made his famous play about this story that was a well-known story and part of our history, and they'll try to tell us today that he didn't really exist. But again, there's evidence to show that he did. It was a part of our history. And there's long been a search for a coin bearing the picture of King Lear, which would obviously prove that he did exist. And I think there may have been some fakes that have been produced. It's the most elusive coin of all is a coin that actually features King Lear on it. I mean, there may have been mention of them centuries ago, but nobody's actually been able to find one today. Lear was said to have been the end of Brutus of Troy's male line of descent, siring three daughters, Goneril, Regan, and Cordelia. And Regan and Cordelia are both names that are still in use today, aren't they?
Well, not so common, but
not so common, but still in use. Regan and Cordelia. As he neared his death, he divided his kingdom among them. Goneril and Regan flattered their father, and at the advice of Lear's nobles, were married off to the Dukes of Albany and Cornwall, respectively. Cordelia, despite being her father's favourite, refused to flatter the king, feeling that she should not need to make special assurances of her love, and was given no land to rule of her own. King Aeganippus of the Franks courted and married Cordelia, despite Lear's refusal to pay a dowry. Lear then gave Goneril and Regan half his kingdom, planning to bequeath them the remainder at his death, but instead his sons-in-law rebelled and seized the whole of it. Duke Maglorus of Albany, Goneril's husband, maintained Lear with a retinue of 60 knights, but his wife then reduced this by half after 2 years. Lear then fled to Regan, who reduced his entourage to only 5 men. Returning to Albany and pleading with Goneril, Lear was left with just a single knight for protection. And I'll just stop there again, because this tells us that you used to have to pay a dowry to get your daughter married off. So Lear had to pay money for somebody to accept his daughter, which is interesting, because in some cultures it's the other way around, and you pay for a wife. But it looks like in our original culture, you paid somebody to take a wife.
Yeah, I'd have thought the wife would be was the possession that was being offered up. You know, it's the traditionally in the Bible, the daughter was kind of property of the man, and obviously the the daughter was had value in terms of producing and kind of securing the person's line, so they obviously had value. So it's quite strange. It does seem a little bit backwards, actually, that you would have to pay someone to take your daughter.
Well, I should imagine they looked at it that this was money that was going to the husband, but it would then get spent on the daughter as well, or it was wealth that would be used for both of them. And I guess the remains of that today is in the expectation for the father of the bride to pay for the wedding.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, that's an expectation, isn't it? That the father of the bride pays for the wedding? Is that a tradition?
Yeah, no, that is. I guess in that context, it would make sense, wouldn't it?
So that's probably where that goes back to, or where we have that tradition from, was this expectation that, that the bride's father would pay a dowry. So he's now left with a single knight for protection. At this point, Leir feared both his older daughters, and he fled to France. He sent Cordelia a messenger when he was outside her court at Caritia. She had him bathed, royally clothed, and assigned a fittingly large band of retainers. He was then officially received by the king and made regent of France, with the Frankish nobles vowing to restore him to his former glory. Leir, Cordelia, and her husband invaded Britain and successfully overthrew his other daughters and their sons-in-law. Leir ruled for 3 years and then died. Cordelia succeeded him and buried him in an underground shrine to the god Janus beneath the river Soar near Leicester, allegedly the current site of the city's Jewry Wall, and an annual feast was held nearby in his honour. So this is where we have references to this actually being a part of our history, is that there was an annual feast, there was a festival that was held for him, and there was a tomb there where his body supposedly was buried. And the city's Jewry Wall, they don't think that actually has any connection to the Jews. They don't know why it's called the city's Jewry Wall. It's sort of lost in antiquity, the reasoning for that.
Yeah, Jewry. I mean, it might not even be related. It could be related to jewels, you know.
Could be anything.
It's only the first three letters which sound the same.
The succession then descended through Cordelia, Caneda, Ivalo, Gorost, Cecil, Iago, Cumac to Gorvod. The two sons of Gorvod, Fir and Por, perished, one in a civil war, the other by the machinations of a vindictive mother. And in them ended the elder male line of the Britonidae, or the dynasty of Brutus. So that was the first dynasty that we had here of Brutus and all his descendants. And of course, everybody after that has been referred to as British in honour of Brutus, which means basically to look like Brutus, doesn't it? You know, Jewish means to look like a Jew. English means to look like an Englishman. And British means to look like Brutus. And that was the original patriarch of Britain. Yeah. Who was a Trojan.
I thought... What's that, sorry?
Who was a Trojan.
Yeah, Trojan.
Obviously white.
So I wonder, would he not have been too keen on securing a male, kind of a son to continue on his line?
Well, he had three. He had three sons. Brutus had three sons, and now we're quite some generations on from Brutus, and this is just at the end of his line, basically. I mean, when you read about the later kings, I think Edward I had something like 30 children, and there was only one that survived to adulthood, and he turned out to be homosexual, I think, if I remember correctly. Yeah. And
oh dear.
Yeah, he was no good. He was not a patch on his father. But there was a lot of infant mortality, and the parents wouldn't become that attached to the child, because they knew that the child was very likely going to die young. Yeah, I mean, it's very sad, really, when you think about it. And even the royalty had that happen to them. Even royalty would have, you know, a couple of a dozen of children, and they would be lucky if one or two would survive. So in some cases, it would just be the females that would survive, and there was no firstborn son to pass everything on to. I mean, that may have been the origin of why in Wales they didn't give everything to the firstborn son. They actually split it up between them. They split the estate up between all the males, which you might think, oh, well, that's good. Nobody loses out and everybody's even. But it means that estates get broken up into smaller and smaller pieces. Whereas the other way of doing it is to say, well, the eldest son gets everything. The other son becomes a priest. And the other one has to go out and become a pioneer and a colonizer. And he has to go and set up a new land, which meant that we were continually expanding, continually building places up. And if you had land and you'd managed to attain a certain amount of wealth for yourself, it stayed in your family. And that ties in with the Jubilee, which the Israelites instituted and that we also used to have here, according to Alfred the Great. And every 50 years, everything would revert back to how it was. So you would get your land back. I mean, it wasn't possible for somebody to buy a piece of land and think that was it. They could hold it in perpetuity. Nobody, like today, people can come to Britain and they can, you know, they can buy a bit of land and it's theirs. But back then, it would have to go back to the person who you bought it from after 50 years. Everything had to go back to zero. Otherwise, to prevent too much, you know, people were amassing obscene amounts of wealth and land and owning everything.
Yeah. I guess what you mentioned about the firstborn getting the whole inheritance, which enabled the others to seek other pursuits, that's very much, that very much ties in with a type of caste system, doesn't it? So it's always kind of keeping things kind of linear and focused and, you know, maintaining traditions, I guess.
Yeah, it ended up causing a lot of trouble, actually, the Welsh way of doing it or the British way of doing it, of sharing it out between everyone, because then you got fights over it. And when we had an English king after Edward I had taken on the role of Prince of Wales because of the problems, so many problems he had with the actual, all these different princes in Wales, they would then have to go to him to settle the fights over the inheritance. And there was all sorts of trouble because they had this different way of doing things. So there's subtle differences between traditions, between all the white nations, basically.
Would you say that that kind of principle is a kind of a type of, would you say it could be classed as a type of liberalism?
Yes, I would. Yeah. I would say that it was. And I think probably the better way of doing it was for everything to go to the eldest son and the other one would then become a priest and the other one would have to go out and find a new land and he would start again and all of his wealth would then go to his first son. And that way we would expand and the wealth was kept and you could retain your name and one person would have all the wealth so he'd be able to do something with it instead of it being split down into smaller amounts where you really can't do that much with it.
I think it definitely sounds like a more kind of productive way. Or I mean, it's the fate is somewhat cemented, isn't it? I mean, to grow up as a second child or a third child, you know full well that what your future consists of and what it doesn't consist of, and so you know you're preparing yourself for life really, whereas if there's three that are going to inherit and have it split, I guess there's no real focus in becoming who you need to become.
And there's no chance of exceeding what your father did either, because all of his wealth is just going to get split into a three. You're just going to get a third of it. So you're not going to start on an even platform with him to try to do even better than him, to pass even more down to your eldest son. So it split the estate up, when you've got a system like that, if somebody was to then come in from the outside with a lot of wealth, they'd be able to buy everything up, wouldn't they?
Yeah, exactly. So what year are we talking here that this kind of started?
That tradition, well, that goes back to Brutus. Well, we'll probably see now, actually, because we're going to hear about the Molmutine Laws, which talks about these things, and it might be in there, because it would have been one of these laws which Alfred the Great incorporated in when he wrote his new law book. Basically, he made reference to the Molmutine Laws. And the triads, the Welsh triads, again, which Wikipedia tries to tell us are forgeries, they have records of what these laws actually were. And there's some traces of them as well in the Welsh law after that. The Welsh used to have a different system of measurement, and they used to have their own courts, because when the Saxons came in, and the Normans came in, they brought a new system of laws. Well, after an interregnum of some years occupied by the contests of various claimants to the throne, Donal Mulmud, we'll call him Donald, it's actually Devonal or Donal, so we'll call him Donald. Donald Mulmud, hereditary Duke of Cornwall and the representative by both paternal and maternal descent of the younger line of the Britannidae, was by general consent recognised sovereign paramount. And his first act was to reduce to a code the civil and international usages which the late commotions had disturbed. The laws, thus systematized, are eminently distinguished for their clearness, brevity, justice, and humanity. They have come down to us in the Druidic form of triads, and we will give a few examples. There are three tests of civil liberty: equality of rights, equality of taxation, and freedom to come and go. So that's interesting. Equal rights, equal taxation, and freedom to go where you want. There are three causes which ruin a state: inordinate privileges, corruption of justice, and national apathy. So if the nation is lazy... And I guess that would be because the king had to set a good example. If the king didn't set a good example, then the nation would become lazy, and there would be, and all these other causes which ruin a state would follow on from it, wouldn't they? You would then get a corruption of justice, and you would then get privileges and bribes which were unearned.
I would say those three things are quite prevalent in today's society, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. All of those are the opposite now. Mm-hmm. And the three tests of civil liberty: equality of rights, equality of taxation, freedom to come and go. We don't have that either. There are three things which cannot be considered solid longer than their foundations are solid: peace, property, and law. So law has to have a solid foundation. Otherwise, it's not law. It's going to fail. And property rights have to be absolutely sacrosanct. And they're not anymore, are they? I mean, look at the way that they're taking all the Russian property just because they're Russian.
Yeah.
All the investments that people have made in Britain are just being taken away from them. Three things are indispensable to a true union of nations: sameness of laws, sameness of rights, and sameness of language. So that's interesting, because I guess you could say they tried to stick to this, didn't they? Because they tried to ban the Welsh from speaking Welsh right up until about 100 years ago, something like that. So they wanted everybody to be speaking the same language, so they had a true union of nations in the United Kingdom. And the sameness of laws. Again, they didn't want the Welsh and the Scots to have their own laws. So that's where this would have gone back to, is Molmutine laws, which were saying this. And of course, now they've changed that, and Scotland can make its own laws in some areas. So can the Welsh. And the Welsh are allowed to have their own language, and the Scots are allowed to have their own language. But has that helped the union? I don't know. I mean, the Scots want to leave, don't they? They don't really want to be in the United Kingdom. Or no, a large number of them.
I think there's a lot of bad blood, isn't there? And a reputation for, you know, how they've been dealt with in the past, I guess. But would you say we was more of a united kingdom before, under one strict umbrella?
Well, I don't know if united is the right word. You know, it was a bit more sort of totalitarian, wasn't it? I guess that the Welsh weren't happy with it and the Scots weren't happy with it. But I think it's going to help if you have the same language, because it's going to be easier for you to understand. Obviously, you've got to have the same rights, and they didn't have the same rights back then, did they? The Normans had different rights to the Saxons. And the Welsh, yeah, and the Irish were treated absolutely awfully. You know, the rights of the Irish under the king, they were treated terribly.
I think maybe if you was doing things like trade or dealings with general things in society, business, trade and whatnot, financial matters, law, you know, maybe have a common thread language. But I think to just outlaw a certain language, that's basically to just erase a part of someone's culture and tradition, and that would really be seen as an attack, and you know, if anything, just put more of a wedge between finding common ground.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it was an attack on the Welsh. It's the same today, isn't it, in Ukraine, where they ban Russians from speaking Russian. There are three things free to all Britons: the forest, the unworked mine, the right of hunting wild creatures. So obviously we didn't have boundaries and enclosures back then, so that the forest was free. You could go through that. That eventually became the King's Forest. And one of the biggest contentions that the British people actually had with the king was that so much land had been taken for the king, and the Britons could no longer use it for hunting in. They couldn't go into the forest. Again, at the time of Edward I, there were all these petitions to him to allow the people to go back into the parts of the forest that they wanted to go in, that they had been used to going in. So you can see there that there was a clash of the ancient British laws with the laws that the Normans wanted to bring in, which were different. So it also says here, the unworked mine. So if there was somewhere that, that somebody hadn't already started mining, that was free for you to use, and nobody claimed a right to owning the wild creatures, which again came in much later. You know, the royalty owns the swans, don't they?
Really?
I think that you can't kill a swan. That's only the queen can eat the swans.
Well, I just wonder if with the surge in population, that some of these laws would have had to be put in place in general to protect the wildlife, you know?
Yeah, but also, I mean, they protect them for hunting, don't they? Just so that the the lords can hunt particular types of creatures. But back here, you could hunt whatever you wanted. There are three things which are private and sacred property in every man, Briton or foreigner: his wife, his children, and his domestic chattels. So his domestic chattels. I don't think it's talking about chattel slaves then. It's not talking about servants. It's just his domestic goods.
I think it's kind of belongings, isn't it?
Yeah. Sacred, private, and sacred property. So it's nobody else's business, and nobody else can lay a claim to them. There are three things belonging to a man which no law of man can touch, fine, or transfer: his wife, his children, and the instruments of his calling. For no law can unman a man or uncall a calling. So that's an interesting one. So you can't take away the tools of a man's trade. You cannot find them, cannot touch them, cannot take them away. And a man cannot be separated from his wife, and a man cannot be separated from his children. Unlike today, where most of the time it's the man who loses the children and they get given to the wife. That was, I mean, to do that, what it says, to do that is to unman a man, is to take his wife and his children away from him. There are three go on.
I was just going to say, what if happens if, what does that say about someone if they're willing to leave their wife and children? Would that class them as less of a man?
Definitely, I would say. Definitely.
Well, rooted in that logic of that law, I guess it would be worse, wouldn't it?
Yeah, a man to do leave, it willfully. Leaving his wife and children. I mean, how can they provide for themselves? You know, they can't. I mean, women today might like to think that they can do everything for themselves with the help of the state, but 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, they couldn't. They you know, they had to have everything hunted for them and brought to them. I mean, they would work in the home, obviously, making clothes and raising the children, while the men went out and did all the heavy lifting and the hunting and the fighting. Women couldn't do that on their own, so definitely it would be to unman a man to have a wife and children and to leave them to fend for themselves. I mean, that's it's like leaving your children unprotected. Terrible thing to do. But they but by the same token, I mean, a woman couldn't leave a man, couldn't just take the children away. There are three persons in a family exempt from all manual or menial work: the little child, the old man or woman, and the family instructor. So the teachers do not have to do manual work. There are three orders against whom no weapon can be bared: the herald, the bard, and the head of a clan. So the herald is the one that spoke the laws out, spoke the news, was the envoy of the king, I guess, and the bard was the storyteller, the man who kept the history of the nation, the historian, and the head of a clan. So we were grouped in clans back then. So you'd have a clan, you'd have a family, a clan, and a nation. And that was how it worked. There are three of private rank against whom no weapon can be bared: a woman, a child under 15, and an unarmed man. So no weapons to be used against an unarmed man, very civilized. There are three things that require the unanimous vote of the nation to effect: deposition of the sovereign, introduction of novelties in religion, and suspension of law. And this law here is the reason why people say there was no resistance to Britain becoming Christian. On the continent, Germans might say, or the Baltic people might say, well, we were forced to take on Christianity by the Teutonic Knights, and they literally forced it on us. But in Britain, we had a law saying that if you wanted to change the religion of the nation or introduce anything new to religion, you had to have the unanimous vote of the nation. And we became Christian in 170 AD, and we had this law. And the only way we could have become Christian is if everybody in the nation wanted to, and there was nobody that didn't want to. And you can say, well, of course, not everybody voted. They couldn't have got everybody to vote. But your representative, your family head, or the clan chief, they would have their vote would have counted, and every single one of them had to have agreed with becoming Christian. So Christianity cannot have been opposed to what we had before. It must have been seen as an improvement on what we had before.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder though, when it became the default or main religion of the nation, if the others were outlawed, you know, like paganism and
Well, it's just the religion of the nation. I don't think it was outlawed. I think the Druids apparently became bishops. The archdruids became archbishops, and the Druidic universities became monasteries and seminaries and libraries, and it just continued. All the recording of the history of the nation just continued. It's just that the same people became Christian because they saw it as an evolution of what they had already been following, of Druidry.
Mm.
Don't forget, they thought that the Romans were, they thought they were crazy, worshipping man, worshipping Caesar, worshipping idols. They didn't have any of that in Druidry. They had a symbol of three rays, which you still see today. In some places, you'll see three marks, like Mason's marks, on the ground. Mm-hmm. And that was their symbol. It was the three rays of the sun, representing the unseen God, the God that was everywhere and that saw everything. And that was the Druids' belief. And they had sin offerings. They used to sacrifice animals for sin. They used to wear white linen. There are so loads and loads of similarities with the Levite priests of the Old Testament, between the Levite priests and the Druids.
Very, very monotheistic religion then.
Yeah. And apparently they had a trinity, which may be where the idea for forgetting, or maybe where the legitimacy for having a trinity in Christianity, where that actually came from, was with the Druids, because they had this idea of a triune God, which is what they called it. Past, present, and future. It was one God, but it was in the past, the present, and the future. And three into one. And the God, I think, was called Yesu. So it even had the same name. They actually had the same name for their God that Jesus was known by in Latin. Obviously, Jesus was Yahshua in Hebrew, and then that was Latinized to Jesus, and the Druidic word for God was Yesu.
That's
either H-E-S-U or Y-E-S-U.
The native language?
The native language was our British language. Apparently, that was the language of the Isinglass, the tribe called the Isinglass or the Isingli. Because there's a reference, I think we may have referred to it last week in the quote from Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett's book, where they quote from, I think, the 8th or the 9th century, saying that the language that was spoken all over Britain was the language of the Iceni, the tribe called the Iceni. So it was Isinglass was the language that we spoke. And that's why we cannot understand German today. We can understand the odd word, but we couldn't converse with somebody in German or in English. But if you are Welsh, you can understand Cornish, and you can understand the Breton languages in Brittany, because they all have the same root. Welsh, Brittonic, and Cornish all do have the same root, and if you understand one language, you can understand the others. Yet if you're English, and we're told that our English has the same root as the German language, and it was Anglo-Saxon is where the English language today originated from, then why can't we understand German?
Yeah, true. But at least there'd be way more similarities, wouldn't there, in the word structure?
Yeah, lots more. There are three civil birthrights of every Briton: the right to go wherever he pleases, the right, wherever he is, to protection from his land and sovereign, and the right of equal privileges and equal restrictions. And I don't think that's saying there the right to protection from his sovereign, as in like the sovereign attacking him, but he is saying that if a Briton is in another country and he is attacked, he has the right to protection from his land and his sovereign. So when we heard about this prince earlier that lost his kingdom in Scandinavia, he came back here, and that's why he was allowed to take somebody. And of course, he tricked them and said, "Can I take double the amount from each town?" And that's why he ended up with so many people. But he had that right to come back here and say, "I need to raise an army. How many people will you give me? Because my land's been taken in Denmark." And that was his right to do that. There are three property birthrights of every Briton: 5 British acres of land for a home, the right of armorial bearings, and the right of suffrage in the enacting of the laws, the male at 21 and the female on her marriage. So that's the right to wear armour and carry weapons, and the right to take part in the making of the laws, suffrage, voting on the laws. And the male got that at 21, and the female got that on her marriage, and you were also given 5 acres of land once you reached 21. That's your right.
It's a lot more than we get now, isn't it?
Yeah. There are 3 guarantees of society: security for life and limb, security for property, and security of the rights of nature. Now, I'm wondering what that is. I'm wondering if that is some kind of compensation if somebody loses a life or loses a limb or loses their property. And what is security of the rights of nature? Could that be something to do with procreation?
The rights of nature. Yeah, I think it's more likely to be something like that over, protection of wildlife, isn't it?
Yeah. 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 I don't think they were giving wildlife rights. They saw that as a lower kingdom beneath man. But yeah, it's a difficult one. What would be the security of the rights of nature? There are 3 sons of captives who free themselves: a bard, a scholar, and a mechanic. So that's saying if somebody is a captive, then all their descendants are also captives. Like if somebody is a slave, all their descendants are also slaves. They're no longer a free man. But if they are a bard, a scholar, or a mechanic, then they are automatically freed.
I wonder why that law would be passed. Do you think it's to encourage people to fill those roles more because it was beneficial to the nation?
Yeah, and also because they're beneficial to the nation. I mean, a bard is owned by everybody, isn't he? He knows the history of the area. Again, a scholar teaches everybody, and his knowledge comes from all the people from the past, and he should be giving all that knowledge to the people in the future. And if you're a mechanic, you should be helping everyone. Shouldn't just be limited to one person. They're gifts that are there to be shared rather than limited to just the one person that owns them, I guess, as well. I mean, they're important things, important roles. There are 3 things the safety of which depends on that of the others: the sovereignty, the national courage, and the just administration of the laws. So each one of those depends on the other. So in order to have sovereignty, in order to keep sovereignty and to keep freedom, you have to have national courage. And in order to have national courage, you have to have a just administration of the law. And in order to have a just administration of the law, you have to have sovereignty, and so on and so on. So it's that's the triangle that you need, really, for a nation. There are 3 things which every Briton may legally be compelled to attend: the worship of God, military service, and the courts of law. So this was before the age of the church. This was the Druidry, and you could be compelled to worship. For 3 things, a Briton is pronounced a traitor and forfeits his rights: emigration, collusion with an enemy, surrendering himself, and living under an enemy. So if you ever give up, you ever surrender, you're a traitor. If you ever move out of the country, you lose your rights and you're pronounced a traitor. And if you ever collude with the enemy, you are pronounced a traitor. And we'll actually see later on as we get into this history where people have actually broken these laws, and that explains the reason why certain things happened to them, or like earlier, why this prince was given an army to go back is because he was relying on the rights under these laws.
So wouldn't that pronounce him would he be living in Britain at the time? I mean, to have a settlement elsewhere, is that not technically emigration?
Well, it was British property. Rather than emigrating to a different country, that would have been seen as British property, like Brittany was called Brittany. And the king's properties that he had on the continent, that was seen as British land. Like when the Roman emperor had built palaces in Wales, he saw that as being part of Rome. I guess it's the same as when you have diplomats, you know, diplomatic immunity. And when you have a foreign embassy, like when Julian Assange was in the Ecuadorian embassy and the British police couldn't go in there because it was seen as being Ecuadorian soil. So I think that would have been in play there. So the prince's land that he had in Denmark would have been seen as British land that was in Denmark. The same as the Ecuadorian embassy was seen as Ecuadorian land that's in Britain. Obviously it's not, but in the eyes of the law it is. So that's what it's talking about here, I think. Or that would have been the difference back then. And also, obviously, these laws were brought in after that Confederate host had gone. But what this Donald Malmertine did, he wrote down these laws. Basically collected them all together. They were traditions before that had built up over time. And he wrote them down.
Mm-hmm.
There are three things free to every man, Briton or foreigner, the refusal of which no law will justify: water from a spring, a river, or a well, firing from a decayed tree, and a block of stone not in use. So nobody can stop you from drinking water. Nobody can stop you from getting kindling, getting wood from a decayed tree. You couldn't chop one down, but you could go to a dead tree. And a block of stone not in use, you could take. And I think that law carried on for a long time as well, because, you know, the stone circles and the standing stones would get taken down and they'd get used for fence posts and all sorts of things after they stopped being used. After they stopped being used for religious rites or whatever it was that they were used for, they became fair game to use for building with, building housing with. There are three orders who are exempt from bearing arms: the bard, the judge, and the graduate in law or religion. So that's similar to the children that couldn't bear arms. And I guess that's because you wouldn't want to lose the bard in a fight. Because if you're going to be bearing arms, it means that that you might end up getting into a fight, you might end up losing your life. And if the bard lost his life, that was all the history and the knowledge that was gone. The same with the graduate in law or religion and the judge. These are intelligent people, the intellectuals, and we need to keep them out of the fighting, basically. Mm-hmm. I think Caesar said that the Druids never used to hold a weapon. They weren't expected to fight. And to attack them was, that was a national incident if somebody was to lay a finger on a Druid. And it says, this is because these represent God and his peace, and no weapon must ever be found in their hand.
Hmm.
Well, we've got a few more here. I don't think we're not going to be able to get through all of them today, I think. So we will continue with these next week. Unless you got anything, you got any thoughts you'd like to add to this at all before we finish Patriarch?
Well, I think it's a stark contrast between the laws of today and the laws back then. And they definitely seemed much more in line with the solidifying the nation and making it strong. You know, it's clearly, you know, what made the Britain a force, you know, to the force it became.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not all about individualism. There's a lot here that ties in with the clan and the nation and remembering our history. Rather than thinking of people as individuals, they knew they relied upon the nation for everything, and the nation relied upon the sovereign, and the sovereign himself relied upon the nation. And it was much more in tune with nature and with the hierarchies that we see in nature, I think. Well, we will continue that next week then. So thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.